WBTV's Good Question is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
They've risked their lives to defend our country. And according to the 2019 census, there were 17.4 million of them living in the United States. We're talking about military veterans. While recognized on special days throughout the year, there's more we could do for them. We're asking, how can we help our veterans?
We tend to forget that the people who entertain us, the people that protect this country, those are real people. Mm-hmm. And they're dealing with very real situations.
This is WBTV's Good Question. Welcome to WBTV's Good Question. Alex Giles here with my colleagues Jamie Bowl and Jack Vandertal. We are joined by Curtis Drafton, U.S. Army veteran and founder of the U.S. Veterans Hall of Fame, nonprofit dedicated to honoring veterans and assisting them with everyday needs. Curtis, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Wanted to first have you just tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and why you enlisted.
Okay, so born in Havana, Cuba, believe it or not. But at 3 months old, my parents migrated up into Little Havana, Florida, and from there we went up to Ohio. So raised in Ohio. I always claim Ohio above everything else. But yeah, background, great childhood in Ohio. Eventually, I wanted to get away from the country, and so I moved over to Texas and joined the Army. So a great 5-year career before I was injured in Afghanistan. And from there, I just put an eye, a real spotlight on veterans' needs around the country based on my own story, which I guess we can dive into a little bit.
What was first calling you to join the military?
Well, I think this. I think that purposefully, all of us have a calling in life. And I chose in uniform. Mm-hmm. Everybody's serving. So, you know, it's really weird when I tell people at like grocery stores, hey, thanks for what you're doing. They look at me like, what are you talking about? But I chose in uniform because we don't have enough people who really fundamentally get what this country's found on. Right. So we'll hear things in like social studies class and different other little aspects. And we'll go, oh, OK, yeah, I appreciate my country. If you really appreciate it, you come to a realization that I can do more. Mm-hmm. I can do more. And so for me, it was like in uniform. I had seen these guys. Actually, I wanted to be a Marine, but I didn't test out enough, which is kind of funny because they'll take like the roughest of the rough. However, you know, but for me, it was like, yeah, I'm more of a tech guy. And beyond that, I graduated high school at 5'4", 100 pounds.
Wow.
So amazing growth spurt at 19. I'm like, God, I could have used this a little while back, you know. But yeah. So I chose in uniform. It was just my calling.
What was that time like with the U.S. Army?
I think this. Some of the funnier stories, some of the bigger guys who come in, you know, gung-ho, ready to go, those guys drop out. For me, it was really just trying to figure out through several sets of other eyes, do you see what I see in me, mm-hmm. right? So every day I'm asking sergeants and drill sergeants all the way up to first sergeants, hey, do you think I could make it in this thing? And they're like, oh, God, this guy's annoying. But, man, he's got some good questions. And so, you know, over the course of those first 3 years, I was just figuring it out. But it was good, you know. And that I think that brought with me a sense of optimism. And so people were looking at me, you know, this little guy, he'll never make it. You know, he's going to be the kind of guy that taps out, cries, whatever, finds a reason to get in trouble so he can get out of here. Mm-hmm. But because of my natural, you know, inquisitiveness, I just went ahead and I just stuck with the program. So for me, it was great, minus my last two tours. So in my first tour, my fiance actually got diagnosed with acute lymphatic cancer. And so that was 2010. 2010, I was in the second wave going over top Fallujah into the Afghanistan mountains. And so when we actually landed, I didn't get the news. Mm-hmm. But I could feel something, you know, when you're tied with somebody, your soul actually feels the separation. And so when I felt something, I was like, something's not right back home. So here we are now, 6 months into that one, when we're going into rotation, finally I get the word and they're like, oh yeah, and you can go home for a couple weeks. You know, well, it's stage four. So I'm like, man, this is a really sucky way to give me news. So I come home a couple months later, she passed. That was August 8th, 2012, from acute lymphatic cancer. And so I had like a 6-month time frame. They gave me like, I took every TDRL I had. I had my normal leave. I used a whole package to just get it out. You know what I mean? Just healthily, mm-hmm. To make sure that I knew that I was prepared to get back in this uniform with no regrets. And just the basic sense that life has to go on. You know, and beyond that, she was a trooper. She taught me the entire time, hey, life has to go on. You're a man. You're going to make it. You're going to be all right. And I'm, you know, the whole time I'm like, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. You know, so she kind of just trained me a little bit deeper in the mental aspect of how to deal with that. So, yeah, outside of that, and then my second tour is when I got hurt outside of Afghanistan, IED. But, you know, that kind of ended my military career. Messed up my neck. I have my C6, 7, and 8. They're still kind of protruding, but I don't care at this point. I'm just like, I'm just going to do God's work and just help people. So, yeah, but military all in all, good to go for me.
Wow.
When you kind of touched on it there, but that's the thing I think sometimes it's easy to forget is the life away from when you're, you know, being deployed and that sort of thing. There is still life going on around you with family and everything else and how that weighs, you know, on a soldier on deployment. Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, I think in modern times as civilians, I see it a lot. We tend to forget that the people who entertain us, the people that protect this country, the people in political hierarchies, those are real people. Mm-hmm. And they're dealing with very real situations. And so for me, I think the only thing that really saved me in that moment was having a spiritual groundedness. I'm a very deeply religious person at the time. At the time, I'm not even an ordained minister. Now I am. However, at that time, I was just like, you know what? I do kind of want to give up a little bit, but if I give up, what does that tell the next guy? Mm-hmm. You know, because somebody out there, and it's real, somebody out there always has it worse than ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not, I don't say that that's the cookie cutter way to approach life, is somebody's always got it worse, but it's a fact. I mean, it's just a fact. And as long as I can hybrid that, you know, the good and the bad, bring them together consensually and just look at life mm-hmm. in an aspect that there's still more. If the sun's still coming up, there's still more for me, you know? So yeah, for me, I think I put my spiritual side above all else, and that helps me get through a lot of dark times.
Was it difficult to focus when you were over there, knowing that your fiance was very sick?
Yes. I'd like to say no, but then there's reality. You know, we like to think that we're always mission forward, but yeah, it's not the case. So yeah, it was difficult. You know what it was really difficult was the normal communication we'd have, you know, so we have commsats that reach back home, you know, and we can use Skype and that kind of thing. So we had built a routine that like every 90 days, mm-hmm. I'd spend 10 minutes with her, you know, and then all of a sudden there's this dark period in 2012, the last 3 months. So basically June through August, where we didn't have that normal rotation of every 90 days bang, you know, so for basically two times that we would have talked. So we're talking like February and then again in June, there was no communication.
Wow.
And so I'm sitting there like, something's supposed to be happening in my life right now, but it's not. Mm. And so, but I'm like, okay, it's cool. I know her situation. I know all these things. I sent her a couple of letters. The normal rotation on that wasn't the same, but I'm like, either way, I'm going home. You know, and you'd like to think as a spiritual person, things always get better. The more people, you know, it feels kind of cliche, but we say, you know, the more people that send good vibes to somebody, the longer they live. You know, unfortunately, there are situations where it's not the case, you know, and we have to, there's two paths you can take. Either you deny or you accept. If you deny it, you're going to get hurt out there, especially in a battlefield. If you accept it, you're like, okay, it kind of is what it is. I'm going to do what I have to do here so that I can get there rather than, you know, both of us being in a dark space, it's best that I do what I have to do now and just take it that way.
I think it takes incredible strength to have to cling on to faith. Where did that strength come from?
Friends, really good friends. That's something about the military is you create a brotherhood and a camaraderie that you won't find anywhere else. And I do mean that. And some people say, well, Kurt, you can't say that. You haven't lived in all aspects and genres of life. I get it. But the military, I mean, we just celebrated Memorial Day. I believe that probably 80% of my battle buddies reached out to me yesterday.
Wow.
Which is really cool. And by battle buddies, you know, you're not saying the entire military. I'm talking about guys that actually served in my unit. These guys and girls reached out to me. Hey, Kurt, what's going on? Just thinking about you. All is well. See what you're doing around the country. Keep shining your light. And I'm like, oh, man, like, forget all the festivities and the barbecues and stuff. As long as this phone starts ringing, I'm in a pretty good space. So yeah, it's the brotherhood and the friendship that keeps me going.
As civilians, are there questions we shouldn't ask of veterans? Like your injury and what happened with an IED attack, is that uncomfortable for you to talk about? Are there certain ways we just shouldn't go about doing that as civilians when we try to understand what you went through?
Right. So I see the pinpoint of that question. And for me, it's this. I think that we've created just in a far realm, we've created this space where you've got veterans on one side of a wall, civilians on the other, right? Mm-hmm. And the common civilian thinks that, well, I can't ask them the question because it might influence or trigger some kind of bad response or memory or, you know, right. something of that nature. And then you've got the veteran on the other side saying, in their minds, I want to tell them my story, but I don't know that they will understand. And so, but neither of them, and I'm also guilty of this, neither of us actually take the time to step back and say, I'm going to give it a shot. They're still a human being with emotions. They're asking the question for a reason, and or I'm being asked the question because they want to understand. Mm. So, but there are some, I'm pretty sure there are some with, and it's not necessarily PTSD, more so than their coping mechanism, that don't want to be asked the questions.
Sure.
Myself, I personally, I don't mind the questions. The only thing I do mind is when they want every intricate detail. You know, that's when it gets kind of hairy. It's like, oh, so how many guys, first off, the good question is, how many guys were in your vehicle when you were hit? Oh, easy answer, 8. Okay, what happened to these guys? And then at that point, I'm like, okay, they were hurt. Oh, tell me how they were hurt. I'm like, okay, now it's getting kind of, because then I do have to pull up in my mind the graphic. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And some of those guys, we've actually talked, because it's almost like a confidentiality measure. Right. So some guys have told me, hey, yeah, I don't mind if you tell people. And then there's other guys who are like, yeah, Kurt, I'm still kind of putting it together. You know what I mean?
But that's the trickiest part, right? It's like there's the generic thank you for your service.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is just sort of, you know, like, hey, how you doing today? Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And then but then trying to have an intimate conversation. You know what I mean? And just I don't know, the balance of that is hard sometimes, isn't it?
It is. It is. And that's something too, like the generic of it. So I mentor at a lot of schools and I'm always out in the community. Alex here, he knows I'm all around the country. And so when we hear it now, it's just what you say. It's like this very cliche,
right.
Non-empathetic, even some degree non-sympathetic, hey, how you doing kind of feel. It's like, oh, thanks for your service. I'm like, I kind of wouldn't even want it.
Right.
I wouldn't want to hear it, you know, if there's no attachment emotionally or spiritually. So I think that because we are who we are as a nation and we're focused on technology and all these things are advanced, we've gotten further away from the human connection, right? So on a mental aspect, on a spiritual aspect, people don't really appreciate people like we used to. You know, right. I'm kind of telling my age, but when I was a kid, you know, when I was a kid, our dad made it a point to tell us always make eye connection.
Yep.
Always be honest and always keep your word. You know, honesty goes beyond your word. So they're two separate things. But we didn't have a choice. Like if I would have walked in the house and told my dad, yeah, some guy was walking down the street. And my dad was almost, and he was nowhere near military. He worked at General Motors for over 30 years, you know, before they were bought out by Delphi. But He would ask us questions pointed as though he was like an interrogating officer. He'd say, well, okay, guy walking down the street, what do you have on? I'm like, what? You know what I mean? But he did that to make it, in a sense, he was teaching us that everybody and everything matters. Mm-hmm. Pay attention to the little things. You know, and we're a very biblical-based family. So, you know, in the Bible, it actually says, be careful who you entertain, because in doing so, many people have entertained angels. So that's why even today I make it a point. I don't care if this guy or girl is homeless. That's somebody's baby. Like, I'll go and speak to him. I'll have lunch with him. I don't mind sitting on the – I don't care what I'm wearing. This is a human being, sure. Right? Mm-hmm. And so to this day, and I teach my team now, pay attention. When we go to these hurricane zones or tornado or earthquake, whatever zone, make a bond. Make a connection. You are not just there to pull bodies out. You are there to make connections to help these people grow after a very traumatic situation.
Yeah.
You know, and if you can't go that deep, I get it. We just won't take you into the deeper parts where we need you, because that's where that's needed.
I love that because it's like in a text message world that we live in, right? Like a text message is good enough sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, that's not the same as you and I looking at each other and talking, you know?
No, not at all. It's a far deeper reach.
Yeah.
Gosh, what made you want to stay affiliated with the military and continue to do work with the military and not go off and do something completely different?
Yeah. So where that starts is, again, 2012, mm-hmm. when my fiance passed away. We had made a vow in 2011 that we were going to start a business that mentored children and brought communities together. So right after she passed away, though, I kind of pushed that off to the side a little bit. And in that process as well, I lost my house. I lost my business. I used to have my own energy drink. I lost everything. And so I became, and I didn't know I was going to re-up in the military, but I became the statistic. I was the homeless veteran. I was homeless for 8 months in Texas. You know, and people look at you and say, oh, well, he can just go to the VA. There are so many constraints and red tape in the VA, even to this very day. We're talking 10 years ago, literally. There's so much going on that a veteran cannot walk in the door and make things happen in the way that civilians might think they can. So, I mean, for instance, if I'm a vet and I ETS, meaning I'm done with my contract, and I walk into the VA and say, hey, I heard that this VA really takes care of us. The first thing they're going to ask me, well, where are your records? And you're like, what? Where are my records? What civilians don't know for the majority, and a lot of active duty don't know for the majority, the DOD and VA are two different entities. Mm-hmm. A lot of your VA facilities are basically IPO'd, so you've got private owners of them. You know, so in the respects of where, like in the Reagan administration, you had DOD VA Connect, as soon as you ETS, your records went over being medical as well as administrative, that doesn't exist anymore. You physically have to go get your records from wherever your last duty assignment base was. And so at the time, like I say, here I am living in Texas. My last base was not Fort Hood. It was Fort Dix, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So just imagine, and this was my case, but just imagine that one out of every six veterans don't have access to transportation to go get it, meaning their records, and or they don't have a complete packet and file to file a claim, which speaks to why we have the homeless and the unemployed and all these other aspects of negative veteran aspect in society, is because we don't have a functioning working system. We could very easily have. You know, you remove your VA out of private and you put it back into government. But being that that's the case, that's why we have 50,000 homeless veterans right now, 1.4 million vets who don't even have sustainability factors in the way that you would think they have. Like, you know, walking in and saying, I need help with housing. You know, the VA loan is atrocious. A story just came out actually yesterday on MSNBC where there is right now a backlog of 250,000 veteran files dating back. A lot of those veterans were from the Vietnam era. So, you know, we're looking at stuff like this, like, how can we just make it simple? And that's really like the easy solution where nobody has to spend the extra dollars. It's just pull one entity over here where it's not exactly functioning and place it here where it used to function. Why it was ever separated, I don't know, but we need to fix it.
Does that leave you feeling, obviously, like angry and disappointed? And when you say stats like that, just of like what a tall mountain it is to climb to overcome this, it can easily feel like a sense of hopelessness, just like, is this ever going to change? Are these people who have like nearly died, like serving their country, ever going to get like the recognition and the service that they deserve? Do you feel that that day would ever come?
Right now, I don't hold out optimism for it in the government aspect. However, in the private organizational aspect, I feel very confident. I just had a meeting with a young man who just a month ago, and the reason we haven't caught up recently is because he just got married. So kudos to him for getting married, but I'll be there. Nonetheless, I just see where like organizations like his, for instance, he has literally created a platform, right? Where any veteran who comes to him can get a claim filed and he can get guaranteed benefits for them. To whereas if I walk in the VA, 9 times out of 10, if it's my very first time walking in the door, they're going to schedule me out 90 to 180 days. And so my problem with that is, for one, if my mentality is not right and functioning right, and I did have this hope of walking in that door and getting a basis or a foundation, you know, laid, every veteran's not guaranteed to make it 90 days, let alone 180 days. And that's actually the average time frame between any appointment. So if I walked in today and said, hey, my elbow's hurting, chances are they're going to say, oh, okay, is it, you know, they're going to do the scale thing. 1 to 10, how's it feel? Anything under a true platform 10, yeah, they're going to say, hey, can you come back in 90, 180 days? Now, just imagine, and that's a very weak example. Imagine if I say I have a mental health issue or I really need these benefits, like me and my family are sleeping in our car. Come back in 90 to 180 days. That's where now we have the 22 up to 24 and a half veterans every day taking their lives. They cannot deal with it. So, no, I'm very disappointed, and I feel as though right now we are not heading a good direction on the government level. But speaking on that, also, we in the United States right now, we have over 43,000 veteran nonprofits. That's a good thing, but it's a bad thing. It's a great thing because it shows so many hearts that care, and they're willing to say, you know what, forbade all else, I'm going out on this mission, I'm going to make a change. It's bad in the sense that we don't get the respect and or the resources we need to do the work we have to do. The average veteran nonprofit pulls in $8,000 in donations a year. That's it.
So then when you watch, as we just passed Memorial Day, and the speeches and the social media posts from politicians saying all these wonderful things, do you eye roll at that? What do you do?
I do. And if the listeners could see my face, yeah.
Yeah.
My face is very expressionary, right. So I should have put that out as a forefront. I do eye roll, and it's because what I do every day is I speak to veterans and communities nationwide. We actually just partnered up with Veterans United Insurance. I speak to veterans across the country. If I were to give you a number and say, well, here's the poll we did, here's how many veterans feel appreciated 365 days a year, 99% say I don't. They only feel appreciated 3 days out of the year. You know, that's Veterans Day, Memorial Day, and then sometimes the 4th of July, of which all of those holidays have what? Veterans Day kind of sales or atmospheres or pitches or slogans.
Yeah. They get a sofa or a mattress sale kind of thing. Nonsense.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
It
drives you crazy,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And my point has been this. When I go to those kind of stores or on LinkedIn or something where I meet the CEOs or some executive level guy, I'm like, well, how much of that money goes actually to the veterans or the cause?
Right.
Very few of them can give me a percentage over 2%. Mm-hmm. So if they make $1 million, you mean to tell me only $20,000 is going to make it to the actual veteran cause and or a veteran?
Yeah.
That's a very sad thing. You're peddling veterans when we live in a country that everywhere you go, God bless America, let's take care of our veterans. But I can literally drive you right now to a space where I know where 3 homeless veterans sleep every night. I've had lunch with these guys right on the – and I'll tell you the intersection. It's right on the corner of Plaza and W.T. Harris. And it breaks my heart because literally less than 2 miles down the road, we have a VA. It's a clinic. It's not a true hospital, but we have a clinic right there at university. And I have literally asked those in charge, hey, why don't you go right down here, pick these 3 guys up. Let's get them in the system. Let's take care of them. We could end their negative situations. And then I've also had conversations with Secretary McDonough, his office, who is the Secretary of the VA.
Right.
They do not plan on doing outreach ever. So when I see things like yesterday transpire where, you know, everybody's in front of a camera, they're laying wreaths, they're putting roses down, they're doing all these things. Oh, God bless our Gold Star families. I hear you, but then I also see you. And as a country, we have to have more accountability. So with this project, that's really what we're doing is we're accountability factor, but we're also an umbrella. We're bringing people together that do the work, right? Who are very well vetted and saying, veteran, you can trust these guys. If it's housing, if it's health, if it's whatever the case is, we're going to make sure we get it for you.
We are talking to Curtis Drafton, U.S. Army veteran and founder of the U.S. Veterans Hall of Fame. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we're going to ask him more about the work his organization does helping veterans and community members.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
brings us to the U.S. Veterans Hall of Fame. Tell me exactly, you mentioned kind of the groundwork there and how this was kind of born out of something that you wanted to do with your late fiance.
Yeah.
When did it actually get off the ground?
So it got off the ground in 2018. And this is the very cool part about it. I'm so blessed with this. So we found it December 18, 2018. What was going on at that time was the government shutdown. Mm. And so we filed all the paperwork. We paid all the stuff for the solicitation, like everything. We got everything taken care of. And then there's this complete six-month period where we don't have anything approved by the government. But we were like, no, let's just keep working. Let's just go out there and help veterans anyway. We're going to get the paperwork. I mean, we know we're going to check every box, right? But let's just do the work. And so right after that, we get like a good year's worth of work in. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, COVID hits. So in a good sense, that's good for us. We've found a way to thrive. However, just imagine if the 2 years of COVID weren't there and the 6 months of the government shutdown. So right now we're 3.5 years old. Without those things, man, we'd be everywhere we probably need to be, because the feedback that we've gotten, people have said, you guys are doing it the right way. You know, you're not hung up on your names, your titles, some kind of fanfare. You guys are literally out there getting dirty. And for the most part, a lot of CEOs or anything like that, they don't want to do the work. They want to delegate, right? You will find me cutting trees. You will find me diving in water. You will find me in houses with the sickest of persons. And I've actually had one of my guys say, hey, man, you got to quit putting yourself at risk. No, man. The dream might have been mine, but the work is ours. I can't just give it to you and say, hey, you know, Jack, why don't you go jump in this building over here and I'm going to go get on WBTV and make sure that, you know, they got a pretty face. For one, I'm not a pretty face. So we need more pretty people. So you guys are welcome to come out. But so with the Veterans Hall of Fame, what we do is we really focus on, you know, you've probably heard the Marine Corps slogan, duty, honor, country. Well, our slogan is duty, honor, country, appreciation. So you've served well, you've served honorably. There are things in your life that you're going to need that we need to now bring to the table. And because we have such good connection that we are able to do these things at a very high success rate. We focus on honor, right? So if I'm honoring Alex or any of you guys, if I'm honoring you, Jamie, Zach, here's what we do. Putting a medal on your neck, that's not honoring you. That's recognizing you. Yes, thanking you for your service or, you know, whatever the case may be. But that's not true honor. That's recognition. Honor is me looking you in the eye and saying, now, what do you need at home every night? Is there food in your fridge? Are your lights on? Do you have a job if you want a job? Are your benefits package? Is that stuff together? So one time a year, Alex came out last year, best MC ever, shameless plug. But we get a ceremony where, yes, we can honor up to 8 individuals per year per class, and we give them a night of recognition, right? However, there's 18.1 million living veterans. It would be very unfair if we only honored, and I'm throwing up air quotes for those who's listening, if we only honored 8 individuals a year when so many others have served well. Mm. You know, this country would not be what it is, the freedoms, the liberties, the economic portions, the political, any of that without our veterans. So we want to find ways, and we are finding ways and implementing them, to honor each and every veteran. And it blows a lot of people's mind. You know, we had one veteran, he was 82 years old. We literally did a walk, by the way. We did a ruck from the Capitol, state Capitol here in Raleigh, all the way to Charlotte. Mm-hmm. Took 5.5 days. This guy was 80 plus years old. He had a little itty bitty, I'm looking at it in my mind, he had a little bitty car fix up kind of garage, you know, back at a country kind of garage. He probably got a car a week, but it was his thing. Mm. But he saw us marching. We're bringing the colors down the road. And this guy comes out. He says, well, what are you doing it for? I said, brother, we're doing it for you because people don't know you. And he just tears up, right? Oh, he grabs his little wallet out of his pocket. He hands me the only dollar I know, because I was looking, the only dollar that was in that wallet. He hands to me and says, just keep doing what you're doing. He said, because my era, we will never see a day like this again. He said, but when I go to heaven, I get to tell God these guys are at least trying. You know, and we've got footage of that. I was just like, oh, man, like. It's such a monumental soul connection when you see something like that. Because a lot of these guys, honestly, back to your question, Jamie, is that these guys feel forgotten about.
Right.
You know, he's out there in the sticks in between somewhere, Raleigh and Winston, because we went to Winston headed down I-40. Nobody really knows who he is, which brings me to the point of, if I'm not wearing like a service cap, right, or some kind of shirt, or if I'm in uniform, People don't know who we are. Everybody in God's creation deserves respect. Not just the veteran, but everybody. However, if we're talking on the sense and subject of veterans, how do we identify? And then how do we connect? Connection is really as easy as just saying, did you eat today, man?
Yeah.
Do you have somebody to talk to that you trust? You know, and that in a lot of ways is a lot of what a lot of veterans need. Because I don't know if you know this, but only 10% of veterans are even above the $50,000 a year mark. And that's a very sad state for a country that can afford to do a lot more, and not just the veteran space, but all spaces.
Is some of this because we ask so much of so few these days, right? You've got guys, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, 4, 5, 6, 7 tours that they're doing. You know what I mean? And it's such a small percentage of people who can truly understand what this is about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I tell people all the time, like, because people always kind of, they come at me and say, man, you're like Superman. And I'm like, I don't want to be, but the work needs to be done. You know, back to the Bible. The Bible says the harvest is plenty, but the laborers are few. Mm-hmm. You know, and then in the military, we say the call is loud, but only a few answer. And that's a very real thing. So you're going to have your guys and girls who, like you're saying, they're doing a lion's share of the work. And they won't tell you how tired they are. Just imagine if everybody did one little, small, yet great thing every day. Like looking at somebody and saying, hey, I care about you.
Mm.
Like, that goes so far.
Right.
You know, and that's become my routine. When I walk up to people who I've never met before, hey, how are you? It's good to see you. What? It's just good to see you. Like, you're here. You're living. You're breathing. Imagine telling that to a veteran who served a tour and might have some kind of a mental setback.
Right.
And or who doesn't have everything that they need after their service. You know, because when we're recruited, what does the Army recruiter say, or any branch? What do they say? Oh, you're going to take that right-hand oath and you're going to give your mom and dad the most proud thing that they could be proud of. You know, you're going to have the future you always wanted, blah, 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 on down the line, right? And then you get out and you run into situations like homelessness, unemployment, all these things, you know, and you're just trying to figure out, how do I make it to the next minute? Mm-hmm. It's no longer day. Because here's the thing. When you leave the military, you're leaving behind a brotherhood. And that brotherhood is, again, not just a sense of mentality. Everywhere I go, there's somebody in a uniform out on the same mission and focus that I'm on. Mm-hmm. So we're team members. We really don't kind of understand what it means to come into civilian life and have to do everything yourself.
Right.
So when you get off the tarmac at the airport and you're walking through the hallways and the banners are up, the flowers are there, the signs are there, somebody's recording your baby for the first time, jumping in your arms. I know Alex, a new dad. When that baby boy jumps in your arms, it's like, oh, man, the best feeling in the world. However, when you ETS and you make it home, the very next day your spouse is looking at you like, well, you're here now. We got these things called bills.
Mm, right.
You know, you don't have that guaranteed whatever your pay grade was. You don't have that every day or every month anymore. Make it happen. And you're like, and you're not fully decompressed. What do I do? Yeah. Where do I start? Oh, well, babe, I'll be right back. Let me run down to the VA and try this thing they call, you know, benefits. I'm sure that'll kick in fast. You know,
as we heard,
The cloud looms low over the VA.
Yeah,
I was going to say, you mentioned specifically before we started the interview, Curtis, that you wanted to touch on mental health, and you have, in some respect, anything else that you'd want people to know about mental health as it pertains to veterans and how it can be helped.
Yeah. So here's the first thing. Shameless plug again. In August, we are going to have a mental health walk in association with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention with Keon Lewis. We're going to have the Mental Health America group out there. We've got a couple of women coming from Miss Universe. As you know, they just lost a very good former North Carolina contestant of theirs, Chelsea Christ. So we're going to bring the community together. And the last time we did this, we had around 3,000 people come out. And what we're going to do is we're going to walk a mile in remembrance of anybody that we lost, not just military, but just anybody. Of course, we're going to host it. However, it's for everybody. But in the veteran mental health aspect, right? So again, 22 vets every day is the average. And for those listening, that does not mean that every day you're going to look up on Google or whatever or obituaries and see 22 names guaranteed. But the average is 22 per day. And actually during COVID, that number was 24.5. Mm. And the reason is because you've got people, again, in a headspace that isn't quite understandable. At the time, in the heat of COVID, we were all isolated.
Right.
You know, you got them confined. So that number went up. In the veteran mental health space, we don't have approved enough by the powers that be the access to mental health therapies, outlets, things of that nature. We need to do more. So right now, not just ourselves, but several partners across the country. I think you might have met one of them at the ceremony. He was from Hawaii. Mm-hmm. That was Micah Gauthier with Mental Restorations. So people like Micah, they're like, what is it that brings you peace and comfort? Is it fishing? Is it going on a hike? Is it just sitting around a campfire? Is it taking a ruck? Is it just sitting around telling old war stories? Whatever it may be, let's try it. Let's just try it. You know, and we've actually been to the VA again, and we've asked the powers that be, like, hey, man, it costs $75 to get a vet in front of a mental health therapist for 1 hour. Mm. That's it. You just got, and literally the number is, they just got a budget for $270 billion annually. That's up 22% from its last budget. Yet and still, when we asked them, we were like, well, you got this much more capital. Why do we need to build more buildings when we just need the work done? You know, why not take that money, divide it up, find the therapist that you can trust, you know, and just say, hey, here's $10,000. When a vet walks in, just check the box. And when you need more, let us know. It could be that easy. However, they would like to think that the approach should be, you know, more buildings, more administration. Very scary story came out of Alaska. So Alaska is one of our bases where just probably within the last 6 months, we've averaged somewhere around 3 suicides a month. Active duty. These aren't, and I should jump back a little bit, and I will, but these aren't guys and girls who are fully out in uniform trying to figure out life. These are guys and girls still in the uniform, mm-hmm. and the base is mistreating them, and they're checking out. They're taking their lives. The government's approach to that, literally, I mean, you can find this story online, was, well, they don't have a sense of purpose. That's why they're doing it. Let's change the entire base into a platform for airborne. So they're saying you don't have purpose because it's not an airborne base. These are just your normal training sessions for cold weather for soldiers. Yeah. They're saying let's change the whole base to airborne because if they're jumping out of a plane, they'll have purpose. And my step back was like, wait, whoa. And I was talking to my partner who's a retired colonel. You've met him, Frederick Dubois. And Frederick served 25 years in the military as a mental health consigner. So he knows the ins and outs of mental health. He's an LCSW. And he said, wait a minute. Why don't they just cut checks for more access to mental health therapy on base, right? You bring in, I mean, out there, I think they've got somewhere around 10, 15,000 troops somewhere in there. I'm not really familiar with their stats right now. But 10 to 15,000 troops. The average case manager, healthily within themselves, can only handle 3 to 4 a day. Which means just bring in 25 mental health therapists. Add those to the 10 that you got on base. Mm. Now we can talk about a success rate. We'll see a pattern better there. So beyond the veteran status, even in active duty, we're not doing enough and because the guys and girls who want, like, literally, if I go to the VA honestly, five times this month,
I know veterans who would want to talk to their social worker,
to their mental health therapist.
And I go to her and she says, hey, how many sessions have you had this month?
However, if they do that, what's going to happen in a week and a half? Their allotment is done.
Yeah.
And so now they got to sit at home. Okay, I just got to manage for 3 weeks until I get back in front of my therapist.
It's too much.
And the whole time they're thinking, oh, but I got bills. It's way too much, Zach. I mean, you're literally looking. I have literally met a guy. I stayed on the phone with him for 3 hours straight. He said, but Kurt, I'm looking down this barrel, and I see light more at the end of the barrel than I do out there in the world. Like, he literally told me that.
Curtis, just going to say before we let you go, I know we've kept you a while here. What's the long-term goal? I know you've got a lot that you're working on. What's the long-term goal with the U.S. Veterans Hall of Fame?
So what we want to do is obviously we've literally toured the country, right, with consultants figuring out where we should put first off the Hall of Fame and our headquarters. We've chosen Concord. Very cool. It's going to work out. Our dream is to have satellite locations of the resource centers and the Hall of Fame. Maybe, you know, here we're talking about building a 215,000 square foot Hall of Fame. It's needed on 40 acres of land. Our veterans deserve no less. And then a resource center where everything that a veteran could need, it becomes a one-stop shop. Instead of me going to the VA and they're saying, hey, well, you know, your mental health appointments, it's 2 hours this way. Your blood work is 2 hours that way. My partner, for instance, he wears a cochlear implant in his ear. He had to drive, even though we have three facilities right here in Charlotte, he had to drive 3 hours just for a checkup, come home, another 3 hours just to go get his implant. So what we want to do is we want to harness everything a vet could need under one roof, outside of the deeper medical things. I mean, true hospitals are sure. there for that, you know. But our network should extend nationwide, and it should have everything accessible here but across the country. So, for instance, if I've got a veteran in Ithaca, New York, and I don't know where that came from, but Ithaca, New York, and he or she, you know, is not making it, and they say, you know what, I just need a change, but I also need access to resources, you know, they should be able, it should be as easy as this with government, but it's not. We're going to do it. They should be able to pick up the phone and say, hey, U.S. Veterans Hall of Fame in Hawaii or Texas or California or wherever this guy or girl wants to see their life start over. I got a vet here who wants to head that way. Within 24 hours, we're going to have access to the resources for a relocation package, average probably like $2,000, to get them to the place where they see their new roots taking hold. Because right now, and it's the same, again, we try to tie everything into community and everybody else. You cannot prosper in an environment that poisoned you. You can't. You need a new start. You know, so if you're not making it in New York, let's try a different state. Let's make sure your benefits are together, all other resources. So we believe that every 250 miles, centrifugist here in Charlotte, the next one would be in Atlanta, for instance. Next one would be up north, somewhere in the Knoxville, Tennessee area. Every 250 miles, we should have an office space where that veteran can walk in and get what they need. You know, and also something else that's coming to Concord, North Carolina. We're building the nation's second veterans village. We just got our first 5 acres. Through a donation. We have a $5 million campaign going on. We've got a grant writer who's a prior Marine Corps gunnery sergeant. Well, I guess I should say once a Marine, always a Marine. But he's out there beating the bushes right now to get this thing going. We have a builder, Chris Axoy. The drawings are on our website. We're going to build functional, feasible. A lot of people hear the word tiny home and they go, ooh, that's those ugly little things. These things are very modern. They're eco-friendly. Right. They make any neighborhood look better, right? And here's the other thing. 70% of veterans qualify for some sort of VA housing loan and or some other kind of loan or subsidy. They can take that money and own one of these homes, one, two, or three bedroom from 380 square feet all the way up to 1,100 square feet. And get a house that they now have a tangible asset to their name, right? So now I can go to the bank and say, hey, I own a home. Right. Oh, wow, loan is yours on this. Or if they want to go back to school and there's no more GI Bill, now the door's open. And, you know, we hear in society a lot, generational wealth. That can't start unless you have some kind of asset to kick it off. So we got a lot going on.
And just real quick, too, if I can, is I think people will, obviously the services and all these things that you're talking about are the critical mass and the most important thing that you're working on. When I hear Hall of Fame, they're thinking like a baseball Hall of Fame where I can take the kids and walk through the halls and learn the stories. Is there's going to be that as well?
There's that synergy. Because the thing is, and it's real funny, like when I got this idea, again, 3.5 years ago now, I was like, how many other Hall of Fames are out there? Obviously, we know about Canton for football. We know about, you know, baseball, Cooperstown. Yeah. We know about all these others. And then I was like, well, let's go really wild. How many other Halls of Fame? There's actually a Hall of Fame in Nebraska for corn on the cob. And I was like, dude, we live in a country literally where there's a Hall of Fame for corn right now.
Go figure.
And I was like, all these other Halls of Fame, we don't have any of them without the service of our military. Right. And I used to tell people all the time, without our military right now, we'd all be speaking either Japanese, Chinese, or Russian. You know, we need to appreciate why we are who we are a little deeper. So, yeah, Hall of Fame, very needed. There are some stories out there that have never been told. And a good friend of mine who's a retired Sergeant First Class used to always say, a veteran story ends up normally in two places, in the grave or in a small box up in the attic to be discovered one day if the grandkids go up there. Not a good thing.
Right.
Not a good thing. So we need to have these outlets publicly with public access where you can just walk in and learn.
Yeah.
Because you can't appreciate something you don't know about. So we want to give the deeper stories in a context that you understand. Now I see why I say thank you for your service.
Right, right.
Because, you know.
I was saying, your ninth grade history book is going to give you the broad view of the battle. It's not telling me the individual story of what Curtis went through.
Right. And I'll tell you this, that chapter in the history book and social studies book about military warfare, it's getting slimmer and slimmer every year.
Yeah.
I before it got the name changed, there was a Vance High School up here in North Charlotte off IBM.
Chambers now, yeah.
Yeah.
It's now Chambers.
Yeah.
When I went in there and mentored, I asked the guys, the kids in there, how many of us love our military? You know, not generically. There was some appreciation. Woohoo! You know, of course. And they had a JROTC unit. But when I asked them, I said, how many of us appreciate Vietnam? Because me personally, I'm a Vietnam fanatic. When I see these guys, oh, man, welcome home. And I hug them. They're like, oh, man, I've never heard that. You know, it gets real emotional.
Yeah.
These kids in that audience looked at me like, a what? And I had like two or three kids say, I think my grandpa went there. You think?
You think? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's we're getting so far away from this is I'm serious. We took God out of schools and work. We took our veterans and military service out of history. What are we becoming? Yeah. Like really, who are we? You know, we are right now in a state of identity crisis as Americans, and we don't have the look we think we have around the world. You know, I offended one guy and I loved it. I still hugged him. But I told this guy, I said, you know, because he walked up to me, I was in uniform. We went to the Army Navy game up in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I was blessed to give the invocation for the banquet. But this guy, he comes up to me, teary eyed. He says, God bless America. I said, yeah, brother. I said, God is blessing us every day, every day. And he says, oh, I tell you what, no other country in the world is better than the United States. And I looked at him, and for me, it hit a different ring, his tone of it, the presentation. I said, can I ask you something? I said, who voted on that? He said, what do you mean? I said, who voted us best country in the world? He said, no, we took it. He said, without the United States, the world wouldn't have the ingenuity and the innovations and blah, 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 blah. I said, okay. I said, I see where you're coming from. I said, can I ask you something? How many times have you been around the actual whole world? Mm. Like literally to be able to walk into a country and say, you're not doing it right. You need to look at the United States and learn a better way. I said, now what we do have, we have the potential to be the very best country ever. Why? Because we have the resources. We have the access. Other countries respect us for, yes, our innovation, our founders, all these things. But can we do more? And he looked at me and said, what more could we possibly need here in this country? And I said, I would love if you just, for the betterment of you, go home, turn on the TV, look at the things we can fix. We are so close, and it's not just my opinion. We are so close to civil war. We can't agree politically, financially. We can't agree on religious freedoms. There's so many things that divide us, but we wear such a good mask. That every time, it's just like when I was growing up, I'm a Chicago Bears fan. People would come up to me and say, oh man, Dallas is America's team. Not mine. No, man, I'm a Bears fan. So my thing is, we do have the potential, and we're very close. Mm. I'm this close to 100% agreeing with that statement that we're the best country in the world. But we have to remove the blinders. You know, when a horse is in a race, you put the blinders on so he sees nothing else. We are a country that has the blinders on. We see where we've made progress, and there's nothing else. There's no problem here. There's no problem there. You know, we throw a few pennies around the world in philanthropy. A lot of people don't even know this. As a minister, I do know this. More missionaries come to America than America sends to other countries. Mm. And it's because they know and see the brokenness and how much better we could be if we just put away the idiosyncrasies. And they're small. They're small. You know, for instance, I go to a Christian church. Very few times do I see people leave the Christian church and talk to the Catholic church less than a block away. And we're walking to our cars in different directions. We might give a, hey, how are you? You know, the very subtle.
Yeah,
but I'm like, when do I stop and say, hey, man, I appreciate you. Yeah. Happy Sunday to you. It's good to see you. Let's talk sometime. Mm. You know, let's trade ideas and theologies and beliefs. And let's learn of each other. We don't even know how many walls we have up. If I were to try to count them, I'd lose count. I shaved the gray off this morning, but a lot of those grays come from just trying to figure out how we can be better. Mm. You know, and with the Hall of Fame, we go above and beyond even the veterans. We're helping communities. You know, we had a food drive to give veterans food, but then we stopped and looked at the whole thing and said, wait, if just within a 2-mile radius, veterans need food, chances are your next door neighbor is in somewhat of a similar situation. So where originally we were thinking, okay, we'll probably feed about 75 to 100 veterans homes. It turned into, what, 542 families. We had a stretch of cars, a convoy of cars, 3 miles long. And it's because we chose to ask the right question. And that is, are you like me? Mm-hmm. Are you going through something, anything? We had people falling out of their cars, crying, thanking God. We didn't let a car leave unless they could not see out of their rearview mirror. And I actually had a girl say, you guys don't have to do this. And I'm like, yeah, we do. When we answered that call to serve and protect our countries from enemies, foreign and domestic, it doesn't say in there, but once my contract expires, don't expect anything out of me. Just don't. No, it's I'm still wanting to find ways to serve. And you're going to find that with most of your veterans. I don't care if they're disabled. If you give them an opportunity to serve in some kind of capacity that they can do, they will hop, skip, jump, slide into that opportunity.
Amazing. Finally, Curtis, just to bring back to your original point, it's my last question. You said that everybody has a calling, and I believe that your calling is ultimately it boils down to helping people. And I feel for myself, Jamie, and Alex, I felt in a lot of ways our calling is to tell people's stories. And I do believe that a lot of good can come of that. But what stories do we need to be telling so that one veteran who, when you come up to them and say, like, hey, you matter today, how are you doing? And tears come to their eyes. How can we best help them? What stories do we need to be telling to help them see another day?
I think it's the story of inclusivity. It has to be the story that, yes, you matter, and there's a space for you, right? If you just tell me that all is peachy keen around the city, you're basically telling a veteran, we don't need you anymore. But if you tell them that our communities are broken or could use their help, you will see them light up like none other. And that's serious. And I've seen the oldest of veterans. We actually went to a nursing facility. A lot of guys and girls were in hospice. We had one guy who had dementia, probably about 84 years old. They told us he had sat in his bed for pretty close to a month. Literally, didn't leave the bed. They brought his food bedside. Able to walk? Yeah. Dementia issues? Yes. When we walked in uniform and just said, hey, we see you. We didn't forget about you. This is right over here at Aldersgate. We see you. How do you feel today? Hey, what would you like to do today? He gave us the what kind of look. Like, you're saying I can do something? Yeah. Matter of fact, we're going right down the road and pick up trash. If you want, I will report to you how many bags we got, and then you can tell me what you think I should do next. 80 plus years old. And yes, we did. 2 hours later, I came back and said, wow, we got about 50 bags of trash, just picking trash up off the streets. He says, well, I think you guys should get yourselves a truck. You know, he starts breaking stuff down logistically and analytically. He's like, he became his former self. It's just like with the therapy where they're finding out when you turn music on, certain kinds of music.
Yeah.
You can activate some of those with dementia, their former selves. For him, it activated his sense of purpose, being, and appreciativeness. Like, he felt like he was part of a team. And literally, his daughter told us, she says, you know, my dad hasn't been that mentally active in beyond the month, several months. So inclusivity, if you just tell the story of you're part of the still existing team. The world doesn't need you right now in military uniform anymore serving your country. Salute to you. You did well. Job well done. Now we need you in this aspect. And that starts at, yes, the younger age. You know, average veteran right now is a 3 or 4 year veteran. We don't have the career at a high percentage like we used to. Just tell them they matter and that you need them and that, you know, there's a space for them. I think you're hitting a home run with that.
Fantastic conversation. Curtis Drafton, U.S. Army veteran and founder of the U.S. Veterans Hall of Fame. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, brother.
WBTV's Good Question is a product of WBTV in cooperation with Queen City Podcast Network and Balto Creative Media. From WBTV, Good Question is produced by Jack Vandertal. Special thanks to Jamie Bull. For the Queen City Podcast Network, WBTV's Good Question is produced by Brian Baltashevitz and Maria Delgado. Production coordinator, Taylor Robinson. It is recorded at the Queen City Podcast Network studios at Huga Coworking in Charlotte, North Carolina.
QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.